From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the comedic drama The Upside, directed by Neil Berger. It stars Kevin Hart, Bryan Cranston, and Nicole Kidman. The family drama A Dog's Way Home, based on a true story, directed by Charles Martin Smith, and stars Bryce Dallas Howard and Ashley Judd. And we'll hear about the international co-production Replicas on Film Week.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
In Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, winner of the Golden Globe for Best Actress Olivia Colman and nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards. Awards eligible in all categories.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. And I'm joined this week by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com. She has a brand new podcast she co-hosts called Breakfast All Day. You can get it at your favorite podcast sites. Tim Cogshell, film critic for Alt Film Guide and CineGods.com. And Charles Solomon, who has a big presence today. He's with Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. He's not only reviewing with us, but Charles joins me along with Pixar's Pete Docter later this hour. We talk about the great Japanese animator Miyazaki, as well as what's going on in Pixar with their busy production slate. But we begin with the comedic drama The Upside, starring Kevin Hart, Bryan Cranston, and Nicole Kidman. The film is based on the movie The Untouchables. Neil Berger directs this remake. John Hartmere wrote the screenplay. At its core, it's a relationship between a wealthy man who's quadriplegic and an unemployed man with a criminal record hired to help him.
You are not qualified for this position.
Have you ever changed a catheter?
No.
Pinch the head, insert.
I can't feel it.
Oh, well, I can.
The Upside, it's rated PG-13. Christy, what'd you think?
This is, yeah, as you say, it's a remake of a French film and a film that was a huge hit in France and it burst all kinds of box office records. And when I was watching it, the original French film, I knew immediately someone somewhere is going to remake this in English with big Hollywood stars.
And took a few years.
Yeah, well, it played at Toronto a year and a half ago, but got caught up in all the Harvey Weinstein stuff, and that's why it's out now. But it is trying to cash in on that same charming, inspiring, true story and just falls flat, never achieves that same level of sly charm. You have Kevin Hart here as sort of a version of the character that Kevin Hart plays a lot. He's streetwise and fast-talking and kind of roguish and kind of charming. He plays an ex-con who just basically needs to show that he has been looking for a job. All he needs is signatures from possible employers to show that he has tried. He stumbles into the elevator of this Park Avenue penthouse belonging to Bryan Cranston, who is a quadriplegic after a horrific parasailing accident, and he is in a wheelchair and requires 24-hour care. Kevin Hart's character is like the only one who does not condescend to him. He's the only one who has attitude and an edge to him and is totally unqualified, and so Bryan Cranston's character says, "You're hired." And it is kind of a standard feel-good, fish-out-of-water, mismatched buddy comedy where the white guy learns to loosen up by smoking pot, and the black
because
guy,
you do,
yeah, and the black guy learns about the finer things in life like opera and modern art. And each of these guys is such a pro, each of these actors, and they're really giving it their all, but they don't have much to do beyond just the facile types they have been given to work with.
And is it very close to the French original?
Yes.
Okay. So even though Kevin Hart kind of has his own special talents, he's still essentially in line with how that character
was
played.
Well,
there's a difference, right? Yeah. In the French original, he's an immigrant. And that's sort of like the issue that he's sort of an illegal. I suppose to hear, Kevin, he's not an immigrant. He lives
in the Bronx and he's poor, but he's American.
Yeah, but there's really not that much of a distance between them except for their socioeconomic status. What I do like about this movie is Kevin Hart. He only stops once or twice to do those little routines, the way that comedians often do in these films, you know. He only does it once or twice. I think he made a good choice in this movie. He's playing this character angry. He's chosen to play this guy as mad. And it gives him a place to go, room to move. And that's the reason why Bryan Cranston's character likes him, because Bryan Cranston's character is mad, too. But he doesn't know how to express being angry. And that little guy over there, he can be mad for me. That's kind of interesting thing going on in the movie. Does it work? No, not really. You know, they've done this film a few other times. Argentine Spanish language one called The Inseparables. There's one called Impuri that's in Tagala. And there's a Bollywood one that's in development right now. So it's a universal story that people love, this sort of idea about how the rich and the young can manage to live together. I wish it were a little bit better, but Kevin Hart is good at it.
They never have the kind of chemistry that they had in the original film, though. What I want to mention, Nicole Kidman gets absolutely nothing to play. She is stuck in this one-note character where she's just the uptight, disapproving executive who does not want Bryan Cranston to hire this guy and has her eye on him and is looking for ways to fire him. She kind of loosens up slightly because she has to get up and dance at one point. But this is just tepid and facile and cliched.
The Upside, rated PG-13 in wide release. Kevin Hart, Bryan Cranston, Nicole Kidman, Neil Berger directed. John Hartmere wrote the screenplay. The family film A Dog's Way Home, an adventure based on W. Bruce Cameron's book, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Catherine Michon. Charles Martin Smith directs. Bryce Dallas Howard stars as the voice of Bella, a dog separated from her owner who has to figure out how to get back home.
Life with Lucas was the best, but when he wasn't around, I missed him so much. It's that squirrel again.
Squirrel, squirrel, squirrel!
Bella!
I was very far from home, but I knew Lucas was waiting for me.
Charles Martin Smith has directed a number of family adventure films like A Dog's Way Home. Christy, what'd you think of this one?
So this isn't really exactly a remake or a sequel of A Dog's Purpose from 2 years ago, but it is the same author who wrote both books both these films are based on. And in both films, you have sort of an episodic structure where this dog is going from one person to the next, to the next, to the next. And we learn life lessons along the way, and everyone's better for having spent time with the dog. And in both films, you have an actor doing wall-to-wall narration, spelling out every single thing this dog is thinking, right? So in the first film, you had
stupid,
right? That's exactly it. In the first film, you had Josh Gad. Here you have Bryce Dallas Howard. And that clip we just played is a really good example of how what she's saying in her voiceover never ever illuminates us at all as to what is going on with the dog. Like, we could infer that the dog is cold because it's out in the rain in the cold and is trembling. Like, it's Lassie didn't have to explain herself ever. And we understood, okay, this is a treacherous situation. I have to assume that the wall-to-wall narration is for really little kids because it's super cutesy, like over-the-top adorable cutesy. So that, I guess, is to help, you know, hold hands of little kids who are watching it. Having said that, a lot of really traumatic stuff happens in this film. You see this dog, Bella, getting mauled by a bunch of wolves out in the wilderness. Right. Bella witnesses a cougar being killed by hunters, and then Bella becomes sort of like the mama dog to the cougar kitten. I mean, awful things happen that are scary and traumatic, and the dog almost dies over and over again. This is not a spoiler. Eventually, the dog has to go home. There is a nice subplot here, I will say, though, with how Bella becomes a therapy dog for several veterans at the VA. And that's a nice role for her, and they need her, and she needs them. And so there is something worthwhile. There's a nugget of something worthwhile in here. But it's just a weird mishmash of stuff, and I did not cry enough. I should be sobbing. I should be sobbing from word one, and I didn't really cry till the absolute end. So that's my standard. Leave me in a puddle. That's what I want.
A dog's not that kind of puddle.
No.
A Dog's Way Home. Rated PG, it's in wide release, starring the voice of Bryce Dallas Howard with Ashley Judd, Jonah Howard King in the cast as well. Replicas, a sci-fi mystery written by Chad St. John, directed by Jeffrey Nachmanoff. Keanu Reeves and Alice Eve star about a scientist whose wife and children are killed in an accident and the lengths to which humanity will go to achieve immortality.
William, something's not right with me.
Tell me the truth.
There was a crash. You and the kids died. I brought you back.
Replicas. Tim?
Oh, boy. Went to see this movie late last night because they didn't screen it for critics. Because
that seems appropriate, though, Tim. A late night.
Which was kind of okay. I'm in this theater, and there were about 25 people in there. And it was dark. I couldn't see. But I'm pretty sure everybody in there was over 50. And it's because of Keanu Reeves. And we have this thing. We can't help ourselves. He's our guy. He's our guy. Even when he makes these stupid, stupid movies, he's our guy. And this big, dumb movie is one that he's in. Jeff and Chad. Chad St. John wrote this movie. Chad wrote London Has Fallen. It was a big, dumb movie. Peppermint, which is a big, dumb movie, and a few other big, dumb movies. And Jeff wrote A Day After Tomorrow, which is a big... These guys just... This is what they do. It's actually literally what
well,
they do.
Well, there is an audience for those films.
The 50 of us, the 25 of us were sitting there watching last night. So, yeah, this is really terrible. And the idea, though, this high concept sort of idea. You got this one guy who's working on moving minds, intelligence from human brains into robotic brains, right? He keeps failing. Got this other guy who's working on cloning. A terrible thing happens, as they say in the thing. The cloning guy, played by Thomas Middleditch, who has never, ever, ever successfully cloned anything, has to figure out a way to clone Keanu Reeves' whole family. Got to do it tonight, by the way.
He works best under pressure.
Yeah, under pressure. They work at this Biodyne laboratory, big laboratory, yet they walk out of this laboratory with like $6 million worth of stuff, and they put it in Keanu Reeves' garage where he grows his wife and kids. And by the way, all of this work is actually being done by Thomas Middleditch, because in the whole movie, all Keanu Reeves keeps saying is, I can't do it, man. I can't do it. You got to do it for me, man. And I'm like, okay. I'm sorry. Go on, Christy.
No, this movie is terrible. This movie is terrible, but enjoyably so. Mm. Like, I'm really glad I saw it. This is a nutty movie, but it's almost not nutty enough sometimes, right? I want full Keanu.
If you're going to do it, crank it up to 11.
I want Nicolas Cage in this role. Like, Keanu is too sedate for this. I laughed out loud a lot at times. I'm not sure it meant for me to.
No.
Having said that, it also tries to be funny, Tim, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it tries to be wacky. And,
but it shouldn't be doing
with
it.
With cloning.
You can't look wacky cloning.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a moment in this movie that ought to be heart-wrenching.
Oops, you had two
when
heads
he
in
choose,
that version. Try again.
Which would happen to all of his other clones. But he cloned his family perfectly. Anyway.
17 days, by the way, is the appropriate amount of time for cloning. You go a little bit longer, they might have two heads.
And
you
in
you
the
don't
garage.
Know.
That's
right.
Nice. You can multipurpose.
Also, it's in Puerto Rico, but it's got to be like pre-hurricane Puerto Rico because everything looks really nice.
Well, it's because the tax credit was in Puerto Rico. That's why it's in Puerto Rico.
That's why they're there. Anyway, it's fun. It's a good, dumb, fun movie.
Replicas in wide release starring Keanu Reeves and Alice Eve. Jeffrey Nachmanoff, the director, rated PG-13. Sergeant Will Gardner, an action-adventure film starring Max Martini and Omari Hardwick, written and directed by Martini Christie.
So this is a movie I feel very conflicted about because it really means well, and it's a really important topic, but it is told in a frustratingly kind of ham-fisted, flag-waving, kind of cliched, overwhelming way. So Max Martini wrote, directed, co-produced, and stars in this as an Iraq War veteran named Will Gardner. And he comes back, and he is struggling to reinsert himself into society and have a life again. But he's understandably suffering from PTSD, and he suffered some brain injuries. He has lost his best friend, which haunts him. And it's about how he goes on this cross-country journey on a stolen motorcycle to rediscover himself, to reconnect with his wife and his son. And there's a lot of like American flag waving and country music playing in the background. And it's kind of painfully hitting you over the head with notions of patriotism. But having said that, there are some lovely, subtle moments here and there. He has a nice exchange with Gary Sinise, who is a bartender at a dive bar in New Mexico that he hits along the way. Once he does reconnect with his ex-wife, played by Elizabeth Rome, there's a really lovely moment, a great monologue that she gets, you know, expressing how she felt when he was gone and how scared she was. He's giving it his all, Max Martini, physically and emotionally, but there's a lot of kind of cringy stuff here. I feel conflicted. I feel bad trashing it because it really it's important and it means well. It's an important message to get out there.
Nothing worse than a movie that means well. Max, who is a noted actor whose face you would know, he's on NCIS Los Angeles right now. Here he has this big gigantic red beard. And he's modulating his voice in this very sort of Sam Elliott sort of specific sort of way. It's different than his own. It's very ruha, you know, this movie. Big speeches about the veteran and what it means and all this kind of stuff. As a veteran, I feel like I can say that I hate that. And if this movie had not done that, if about half of the dialogue that comes out of his mouth stayed inside his head, this movie would probably be okay. Omari Hardwick actually doing a pretty good job here.
It spells a lot out. And then there's that whole unfortunate subplot where Lily Rabe thinks that he's Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
It's not funny.
Sergeant Will Gardner, the action-adventure film starring Max Martini, who wrote and directed as well. It's unrated at the AMC Burbank Town Center. We have many more films to talk about with our critics, and then Charles stays around as we talk with Pete Docter of Pixar about what's going on with their animation. Back in a minute. I haven't had a chance to check where we are on ticket sales for our upcoming Film Week Academy Awards preview, but I do know we sold out last year, and I'd like you to get your tickets while there's still time. It's Sunday, February 17th, that afternoon at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We're back there at the beautiful historic theater on South Broadway. All of our Film Week critics will be there, including the three who joined me today. Sunday afternoon, February 17th at 1 o'clock, we'll see the clips of all the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures, a chance for some members of the audience to ask questions of our critics. You always get great, insightful questions from those that attend the event. Tickets are at kpecc.org/in-person. I hope to see you Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel. Our critics joining us this week, Charles Solomon, Animation Authority, Tim Cogshell, and Christy Lemire. Next up is the animated film from Japan, Modest Heroes, Ponoc Short Films Theater, Volume 1. Charles, that's a bit of an unusual title.
Yes, well, when Miyazaki announced his retirement in 2016, Ghibli cut way back on their staffing, and a lot of the artists went to a studio a veteran had started called Studio Ponoc. And they very quickly did Mary and the Witch's Flower, very, very polished first film, a little bit close to Ghibli in its look, but a good, solid feature. And so to try and develop new talent and explore some more styles, Nishimura, who's the head of the studio, commissioned these three films from his audience, from his artists. So there are three shorts that all deal with the idea of heroism in everyday life. And I particularly liked one called Life Ain't Gonna Lose. That's about an elementary school boy with a very serious allergy to eggs who inadvertently gets some in ice cream and has to, you know, deal with the problems. He's a very winning little kid. It's something we would never do in an animated feature. Similarly, Invisible Man, Invisible is about a man who is invisible and really explores the alienation of someone who is just not seen by society, literally, and it becomes kind of a metaphor for rejects, who's finally willing to sacrifice himself to save a child that's in danger from an accident. And then Yonabayashi, who directed Mary and the Witch's Flower in two films at Ghibli, does one about two children who are actually the embodiment of freshwater crab spirits. They're these little underwater characters who have to learn to look out for each other when their father is swept away by the current. They're very different. They're very charming. The one sad note is it was originally going to be four films. Isao Takahata had agreed to do one, and then he died last year and wasn't able to. But it's also just very encouraging to see a studio saying, okay, even if there isn't a huge amount of money in this, let's see about developing our talent. Let's see what visuals we can work with. Let's see what kinds of stories we can do. And just putting out these little short films, and they have plans to keep doing them. So I really enjoyed them and would recommend them.
And sounds like something to support, too.
I mean, yes.
If you really want to support creativity in animated filmmaking, this is a way to do it.
Yeah, it would also be nice if there were some similar things for live-action filmmakers here.
Yeah.
that, again, would let younger artists try new and different things, and we might get better full features as a result.
Yeah, that aren't just sort of calling card shorts.
Yes.
Modest Heroes, Ponoc Short Films Theater, Volume 1, Japanese Animated Films. And it's Saturday only that this is in selected theaters. So Saturday is your only chance to see it. The films are rated PG. And it, Charles, sounds like, I mean, this is for all ages?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't take very small children to it, but later elementary school, junior high, fine. There, and I think particularly the one about the boy with the allergies would make a really good opening way to open a conversation between parents and their children about, do they have these problems? Do their friends have these problems? How do you react if you see someone else dealing with this, and how to respond to them?
Next up, Perfect Strangers, Perfectos Desconocidos from Mexico, a comedy drama that's directed by Manolo Caro and written by Filippo Bologna and Paolo Castella. It's based on an Italian film of a couple years ago that Bologna and Castella did. Christy, what'd you think of Perfect Strangers?
So this is fun, and it has some snappy dialogue and some twists along the way. It's kind of soapy and juicy, and I enjoyed it. It is about a group of friends, several couples, and then one guy who shows up solo. And they have all known one another for a long time. They have plans to go on vacations together, and kids are friends, that kind of thing. And they meet at one couple's very opulent home for a dinner party. And as they get to talking, they all kind of complain about how we're so reliant on our phones, and we constantly have our face in our phones, and we should just all put our phones down. But let's play a game with it. Let's put our phones in the center of the table, and if anyone's phone pings with a text or an email or a Facebook notification, that person has to read the contents of it for the entire table. There are no secrets. Whatever comes up, it's fine. We don't have any secrets with each other, right? We all know each other very well. What do we have to hide? It'll be fun. It'll be mundane things about, like, dental appointments and kids' birthday parties and that
this
kind of thing.
This is always a terrible idea.
It is.
Yeah, it's
right?
Almost like putting your keys in to, for a wife swapping. Yeah.
There you go. This is like a phone swapping thing.
That's usually a terrible idea.
So it's it starts out in kind of a lighthearted way, some embarrassing things here and there. But then one guy realizes, okay, I'm going to get a photo from somebody and my wife can't know I'm getting it. So let's swap phones for a bit. You and I, who have the same phone, let's swap phones just for one half an hour or so. And that leads to a whole other series of misunderstandings because that guy has his own secrets on his phone. And it's light at first, and then it gets darkly funny, and then it just gets dark. And it's, in theory, it's an indictment of our over-reliance on our communications devices. You know, maybe we wouldn't have all these secrets if we didn't have the methodology for maintaining them, right?
Oh, sure. That's
so, maybe that's it. I will say that it gets really melodramatic and really over the top toward the end, and then it kind of pulls the rug out from underneath you. Oh. I can very easily imagine, not unlike The Upside this week, I can very easily imagine an English language remake of this with a big cast.
Well, this is a real, I mean, that's really dancing on a razor's edge, all the different tonal kinds of switches that
yes.
Perfect Strangers undertakes. Mm-hmm. It's in selected theaters and unrated. Rust Creek, a thriller that's directed by Jen McGowan, written by Stu Pollard and Julie Lipson. Tim?
This is a resilient, clever girl who will kill you if you make her movie. But she doesn't want to kill you. And it's sort of a new genre. There's a little movie last year, I think, called Revenge. It was sort of the same thing. There have been two or three of them, right? You know, a young woman involved in a situation with these men and finds herself being tracked and stalked by these men and has to rise to the occasion, as she does. In this particular one, she's driving upstate. Her GPS takes her off a map. She ends up out in the middle of nowhere. These sort of hillbilly types, one of whom is played by a guy named Micah Hopman, who's very, very, very good. I like Micah. He's just wonderful. He's just playing this hillbilly, scary as you ever wanted to see. And she tries to get away from him, ends up, you know, in a situation. Now, the movie here has way more story than it needs because we end up in this whole sort of meth cooking situation, and there's something going on with the sheriff and all of this. But she gets driven deeper and deeper into the woods until she decides, you know what, I'm not running anymore. And then it becomes one of those, I told you, I'd kill you if you made me.
You compare it to Revenge. Revenge has style.
Yeah.
This does not. This is pretty straightforward. This reminded me more of Winter's Bone. This is like a low-rent version of Winter's Bone, where we have this plucky young woman taking us into like the depths of hell in Kentucky meth country. I found the
Kentucky meth country.
It is.
I love that sentence.
It is. It's more interesting when it's about this slice of life in this place and time where people are just desperate and they're doing what they have to do to survive. She's not all that well developed as a character. We know from the beginning that she's a runner, and that serves her well in terms of her, you know, her resiliency, her resourcefulness, and her ability to fight back. But we don't really know a whole lot about her. I mean, she's got some intern she's driving to interview for, but like, what's it even about? Like, what is she studying? Not a whole lot about her. So,
Hermione Corfield stars in the film Rust Creek. It's rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. The Lithuanian-U.S. co-production Ashes in the Snow, romantic film starring Belle Pauly and Martin Wallstrom. Marius Markovicius is the director, and Ben York Jones, the screenwriter. Christy.
This is about a segment of World War II that I really did not know a whole lot about. Did you, Tim?
No, not exactly. It's unremarkable, though, but I didn't know about this specifically.
About this specifically, I did not know. About under Stalin's regime, rounding up people and just sending them off to labor camps. And Belle Pauly is a teenage girl in one such family in Lithuania. And she is 16, and she is a promising young artist, and she lives a comfortable, happy life with her family, and it's how they get swept up and ripped apart and how they survive. It is relentlessly bleak, but within that tonal bleakness, there is some really striking imagery, especially when they get to their ultimate destination, which is this labor camp in Siberia. Like some of the widescreen shots of just the snow and the cloudy backdrop are really beautiful, but there's not a whole lot in terms of variance of tone, and I guess it's meant to be an inspiring story of survival.
Well, I suppose there's a little bit of a love story insinuated in there, in a certain sort of way. But yes, it's deeply moving, and depictions of the sort of man's inhumanity and all of that we know from movies like Schindler's List and many others now. And in that way, it is unremarkable. And maybe that's me, because, you know, you've come to see these moments again and again and again in these movies where these, in this particular case, Russian soldiers are being brutal to these Lithuanians and killing them willy-nilly. And it can become numbing in a certain sort of way. And so so important, yes, but unremarkable.
But the young man in this is also the young man who finds the dog in a dog's way home.
So that's the timing.
In that way, it's remarkable.
It's a long trip for the dog.
Ashes in the Snow.
From 1941.
Lithuanian U.S. co-production. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and it's unrated. Also screening at the Music Hall, The Aspern Papers, starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Vanessa Redgrave, Jolie Richardson. Julian Landes is the director of the film and co-screenwriter. Tim?
Debuting director, where there is a spinster, a rich spinster, and a young, handsome man, there will be a seduction. because that's just the way it works. It's particularly in a Henry James novel, and this is based on a Henry James novel. There are 24 producers on this movie.
Oh my God.
24.
And three countries involved.
Yeah. You know, including much of the cast. And James Ivory, of course, is one of the producers who, of course, made many Henry James adaptations. This isn't very good. But for the Redgrave family, Vanessa and Jolie, they have these moments where they get to do what they do, particularly Dame Vanessa, and they just eat the scenery. But everybody else, no.
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is shockingly miscast in this. He's doing this very flat American accent, and he is awful. He is just really stiff. Like, he's somebody with a really dangerous kind of fascinating screen presence, which is so tamped down here. He does not get to do what makes him interesting here at all. He's never charming. He's never sly. But Vanessa, watching Vanessa and Jolie together is a nice, rare treat. It does not happen very often.
So we want to see that in future films that are better than, clearly.
Yes.
The Aspern Papers. Based on the Henry James novel, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Vanessa Redgrave, Jolie Richardson star. It's at the Music Hall, Lemley Theater. theater in Beverly Hills, and it's rated R. Coming up, Charles Solomon sticks around with me as we'll talk with Pete Docter of Pixar Animation, not just about the very latest developments at Pixar, but we'll also talk about the great Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who is being honored Saturday night by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association for his remarkable career. And he's working on a new film right now as well. So that's how productive and busy the giant of animation is. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in just a couple minutes.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, winner of the Golden Globe for Best Actress Olivia Colman, and nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Lead Actress Olivia Colman, Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Acting Ensemble, Original Screenplay, Editing, Production Design, Costume Design, Cinematography, Director Yorgos Lanthimos, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Great to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. The Los Angeles Film Critics Association holds its annual awards dinner Saturday night in Century City. Its honorees have already been voted on and announced. Roma will receive the Best Picture Award. But every year, one of the highlights is LAFCA's Career Achievement Award. The previous recipients make up a who's who of cinema. This year, another giant of movies is being honored, director and animator Hayao Miyazaki. The co-director of Japan's Studio Ghibli has made some of the most acclaimed films in history. My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away, and Howl's Moving Castle. At age 77, he's working on a new feature, How Do You Live? Miyazaki isn't fluent in English, so we've invited two huge fans of his artistry, our Film Week critic Charles Solomon and the chief creative officer of Pixar Animation Studios, Pete Docter, himself, writer, director of great animated films like Inside Out and Up. Pete, Charles, good to have you both with us today.
Always glad to be
Thanks.
Here.
Charles, let me start with you, because you've spoken all these years on Film Week about reverence, probably is not an overstatement for how you feel about Miyazaki. Why is he so important as an artist?
Well, I think genius is a horribly overused word in our culture today, and I think the art of animation has really produced three. There was Winsor McCay, who basically created an art form out of nothing. Walt Disney, who completely re-envisioned what the art form was capable of, and now Miyazaki, who's given us yet another completely original vision of what animation can achieve. And if you go anywhere in the world, from Toulouse to Toronto to Tokyo, you talk to artists, they will all say, yes, Miyazaki is one of our major influences because his work is so good and so beautiful that everyone studies it and wants to learn from it.
Pete, one of the things that I'm struck by with every Miyazaki film I've ever seen is is the way he's able to convey emotion without sentimentality. And I wonder if you can speak to that, how his movies are so compelling. I mean, you've had that kind of success with Up, certainly, where people were deeply touched by the film.
I cry every time I see it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, he has this amazing balance. And, you know, I don't think anyone could watch one of his films and say those characters aren't enormously compelling and cute and appealing. And yet he'll also balance it with just enough kind of gross stuff or surprising, shocking elements to make you never quite know what you're going to get. And I think that's one of the joys of watching his films.
Well, I was also going to jump in and say that even in Spirited Away, probably his most celebrated film, the heroine, Chihiro, begins, she's sulky, she's petulant, she's skinny, she's frowning. But as she's put through trial, she discovers reservoirs of love and strength and courage that she didn't know she had, and neither did anyone else. And I think, Pete, that could also be said of some of your characters, that certainly neither Russell nor Carl in Up begin as the most prepossessing people in the world, yet you grow to love them as you see them grow and warm up.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I think, you know, secretly, I think all animation directors want to be Miyazaki because he seems so self-possessed and confident in what he's saying. He seems like he puts forward these ideas just as concepts that are pretty far out, some of them. They're not easy sells to an audience, and yet they're so compelling and universal, and I think also subtle. You know, they're not overtly stated, oh, here's the character with the problem. You know, it's just, here, I'm on this journey, and I really don't know where this film is going. It's kind of unpredictable structurally.
Well, something else I think he does exceedingly well, and that you do too, Pete, is you silence, and you don't talk the audience to death. You know, I half joke that, yes, I cry whenever I see Up, but that montage that summarizes Carl and Ellie's life together would be so tedious and so unmoving if you talk through it, just as you don't need the two little girls talking when they're waiting for their father in Totoro. The visuals and the music just carry it, and you know what they're experiencing.
Well, thanks. We started with that sequence, making it a series of little cuts with dialogue and sound effects and everything. And as we developed it, we kept stripping away to the point where there's nothing other than music. If you watch it, there's not even sound effects. And I kind of feel like you connect deeper because it's asking the audience to participate. They have to kind of introduce their own ideas of what they're talking about or what sounds are going on. And so it becomes more real in your own head, I think.
Well,
and that's my pet theory.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Pete. The other thing is that for Miyazaki, when I think of his films and scenes that have really been powerful, there's no dialogue, but you'll hear little background, like little footsteps or the wind blowing the leaves. There's something, he's very gifted at how he uses sounds in his film. And I wonder, Pete, if that's something we think less about, but that is every bit as important in animation.
Oh, absolutely. And I think beyond the sound, just the importance of nature, things that if you were being very critical and you just needed to trim for time, you'd be like, I don't need this splash or this drop of water on a leaf or what, just get rid of that stuff. But no, that's I think what transports you. It makes you feel like you're in that forest, standing at the bus stop waiting along with the kids. You know, he has this ability to know what details to bring forward so that it just becomes more visceral and alive.
Well, yeah, and I would say in a lot of American animated films, you get the feeling you're being grabbed by the lapels and told you're having fun, whereas Miyazaki will show you a girl lying amid the flowers watching the clouds drift by, and he just sort of offers you his hand and said, here's a journey, let's go.
And it enables you to feel as though not just that you're there with her, but somehow you're inside her head. You're getting insight into how she experiences not just how you would experience if you're laying in that same meadow. We're talking about the great Japanese animator Hayao Miyazaki, who's being honored Saturday night in Century City by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. It's their Lifetime Achievement Award, the Career Achievement Award, that's gone to some of the giants of filmmaking, directors, actors, others who've been pioneers of global cinema. Miyazaki certainly standing at the top among the greats in global cinema for the work that he's done with all the terrific animated films. Charles, as someone who's very keyed into animation education, how is Miyazaki taught? Someone goes to art school or to animation school. How do you teach what he does? Is that possible?
Well, I don't think too many people need to be taught. As if you're an animation student, you come in sort of already steeped in Miyazaki. I remember when I was at, I taught a class at Chapman this semester, and when I showed, some of the students were asking about, well, had I been to Japan, had I talked to this, and I showed them a picture of me with Miyazaki, and they couldn't have been more impressed if I had been with the Shroud of Turin. what you can do is talk about, okay, here's an example, for example, in Totoro, of the two little girls meeting him. Then you can show them Hiccup and Toothless meeting in the first How to Train Your Dragon movie and say, okay, Dean has talked about how we learned from Miyazaki, and here's how to present this very complicated relationship silently but effectively and movingly.
We're talking about Hayao Miyazaki, the Japanese animator, who again is being honored Saturday night by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. And we'll continue our conversation with the chief creative officer at Pixar Animation Studios, Pete Docter, the man who wrote, directed Up, Inside Out, and other Pixar favorites. He's part of the Brain Trust at Pixar. And we're going to talk with him as we continue about how that collaborative approach works at Pixar and how the other creative giant at Ghibli Studios in Tokyo also is a major player in the work of Hayao Miyazaki. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, and I sure hope to see you coming up on Sunday, February 17th, the afternoon event theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, our annual Academy Awards preview. Charles will be there with all of our Film Week critics on stage at the Ace. Tickets available at kpecc.org/in-person. We're back in just 1 minute. Such pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our animation critic Charles Solomon is joining me as we talk about the honoree for a Career Achievement Award by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese animator who will be there to receive the honor. Oh, he won't be there. He's not coming.
No, he's 77 and in the middle of a film.
So he's not. All right. He's not breaking away.
No.
Okay. He will not be there, but in absentia will be honored. We're talking with Pete Docter as well, who's the chief creative officer at Pixar Animation Studios, about Miyazaki's extraordinary body of work, its impact on animators. And as Charles said, he is working on yet another film. I thought he was going to retire, Charles.
He's retired.
But when I first met him in 1999 with Princess Mononoke, he was saying, oh, I'm going to have to retire soon. I don't have as much energy. My eyes are getting aren't as good as they used to be. And he's been talking about it ever since. He retired. He started a short film for the Ghibli Museum, where he makes shorts that are only shown there. He got a new crew of young computer artists who came in. He got excited and got an idea for a feature.
So here we are with yet another. I wanted to ask you, Pete Docter, about the teamwork in animation. We often see with animated films two, sometimes even three directors that are involved with making a film. We're aware of the Pixar Brain Trust, where the group of you all made your own films but collaborate, give feedback on what each of you are doing. Isao Takahashi is the other great animator, part of Studio Ghibli. How important was he in influencing what Miyazaki was doing and vice versa?
Well, I think they both admired and sort of saw things that they would do differently in each other's work. You know, there were no secrets about. They had a little bit of a rivalry, but also a love for each other, I think, and each other's work. But there's a really interesting contrast, and I'm fascinated by this, in working methods between, I guess, what you'd call Western filmmaking, starting with Walt Disney, and the way those guys work. They are much more single person focused. Now, it's an extreme to say that, because I think each individual animator does contribute in very meaningful ways, and they help shape the sequences. But just as an example, we have a team of anywhere from 6 to 10, 12 story artists, right, who help us create the story and the outline for the film, what's going to happen. Miyazaki boards the whole thing himself. He is the only story artist. And when he visited Pixar a number of years back, we told him this, and he kind of shook his head and said, if I could only figure out how to do that, that he would prefer – he said he'd prefer to have a bunch of story artists because it's a lot of work. But it's just a very different kind of a way of working. I think some of it's cultural. Some of it's the fact that he grew up in television, and that was where he kind of cut his teeth, that they really do rely on these key figurehead artists to drive a lot of this stuff.
Well, also, when you look at Miyazaki's storyboards, he's pretty much made the whole film. All the expressions are there, camera movements are there, notes on the animation are there.
Yeah.
You know, are you that thorough when you're boarding, Pete?
Well, you could say there are some sequences that if you go back and look at the storyboards, you know, the sequence we were talking about in Up, Married Life, that is almost shot for shot what Ronnie Del Carmen boarded. But it's a very communal, collaborative effort for us. And I think it is for them, too, but not to the same degree that the way we work. Even when you go back in history, and Charles and I are both very fascinated by Disney history, and Walt is certainly a singular voice, had strong opinions about things, knew down to detailed like ink lines on characters in Snow White. He knew everything of what was going on. But even he, I think, was less sort of directly the auteur of the films that Miyazaki is. Would you agree with that, Charles?
Oh, yeah, because he also had crews, and you were talking, Pete, about how the animators contribute. In the new documentary, Neverending Man, there's, I think, a really revealing sequence when Miyazaki gets mad at an animator and tells him, you're drawing people, not just characters.
Yeah.
Pete,
which is similar than – sorry.
No, finish your point, please.
I was just going to say that's very similar to the way we think, and I know Walt Disney thinks that these characters become very real. They become like people that you know, and they can complete their own sentences, and they come alive in your head. And I think that's one of the keys to his great work, is that he does think of them as real people. He bases it, I got to believe, on just really second to none observation, things that he's seen, details, behaviors, the way a little kid eats soup, or you know, just simple things, how they won't just stand still. They're like scratching their leg with their other leg, or, you know, these amazing details that are what really bring it to life and make those characters so real.
I wanted to ask you, Pete, also about just Pixar, because you've had so much change over the course of the past year with John Lasseter, the founder, leaving the company, co-founder Ed Catmull announcing he's going to be stepping down next year. You're taking over the creative leadership of Pixar, Jennifer Lee, who co-directed Frozen, a Disney animation. Things at Pixar were so stable for so long. Now you've got all these big changes. How was the staff digested all that?
Yeah, we were really spoiled. The sort of stability doesn't happen often in Hollywood, much less the world. But yeah, I think the amazing thing now is we have this great opportunity to bring new voices to the table. We have 10 films at Pixar in varying stages of all the way from production to development. And most of them are new directors, people that you haven't seen before, that are going to come bringing their own perspectives of where they came from and the way they look at life. And that's, I feel like, the key to our creative ongoing legacy, is to bring forth new stuff, surprise people.
Well, and along those lines, you're working on Toy Story 4. You've got three critically acclaimed films that precede it. And, you know, I've just heard anecdotally from some people who say, well, why, you know, you're 3 for 3. Why take on the risk of a fourth? And is that going to the well too often? How do you respond to that skepticism?
Well, those characters are strangely really giving in a lot of different angles and dimensions. And so we've had a really good time. It's not been easy. This has been a tough one. But they all are, you know, exploring other sides of Woody and some of the other characters that you haven't seen before. So I hope we'll surprise you with this one.
We're talking with Pete Docter, who's the chief creative officer at Pixar Animation Studios. Joining us from Pixar, Charles Solomon, our animation and film critic for Film Week, joining us in our Film Week studios as we talk about the L.A. Film Critics Association Saturday night in Century City, honoring with their Career Achievement Award the great Japanese animator, filmmaker Hayao Miyazaki, who's getting the Career Achievement Award in absentia for his terrific work and yet at work on another feature film. Charles, just in closing, quick thing for us to think about Miyazaki and his legacy.
He's simply better than anybody else working today, which is why everybody admires him and is influenced by him.
All right. Charles, thank you so much. Pete, a pleasure. Thank you, and wish you all the best at Pixar. Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, we remind you that our Film Week Academy Awards preview is coming up Sunday afternoon, February 17th, just a week before the Oscars. Great chance for you to see all of our critics on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We'll show clips of the Oscar-nominated films. It's a great time. Last year sold out. Get your tickets now. KPECC.org/in-person. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week.